sanctions against Russia, including the supply of certain high-tech U.S. components important to Russian industry. In mid-May 2014, Russia retaliated. Prior to this freeze, the United States had planned to keep the ISS operating until 2024, 4 years longer than the previously agreed mission end of 2020. Now, Russia's deputy prime minister announced that his country would not only not collaborate on the ISS past 2020, but would also, in certain instances, stop exports of Russian rocket engines to the United States, a potentially crippling move that would ensure Russian space dominance in decades to come. U.S. Atlas III and Atlas V rockets use Russian-made RD-180 engines. U.S. Antares rockets use Russian-made RD-181 engines. Dozens of important U.S. missions, from deep space probes such as the Mars Curiosity rover to spy satellites and early warning satellites, as well as ISS cargo shipments, were boosted to their destinations by Atlas or Antares rockets. U.S. military reliance on Russian rocket engines had become a dependency, a collaboration of sorts. United Launch Alliance, a partnership of Lockheed Martin and Boeing that in 2014 held a near monopoly on launching U.S. military satellites, manufactures the Atlas V rocket. Under the letter of Russia's new export restrictions, only rockets for military launches would be prohibited. But in practice, it would become hard for the United States to import any rocket engines at all. Congress responded to the 2014 Russian engine ban with an engine ban of its own. Although the ban was lifted in December 2015, certain members of Congress continued to press for its reinstatement. As of early 2016, according to the website NASASpaceflight.com, those who contended that Congress was placing Russia's economy ahead of U.S. military and national security interests were decrying those who wanted to guarantee launch market redundancies until a U.S.-made successor to the Atlas V's engine was truly ready for prime time. The pro-ban forces lost. By the end of 2016, Russian sales of rocket engines were back on track. TASS, the Russian news agency, announced that Russia would be delivering 19 engines to the United States in 2017, pointing out that the U.S. Congress had imposed a ban on the use of these engines after 2019 amid deteriorating relations with Russia, but later lifted it when it became clear that the United States would be unable to develop engines of its own in the next 3 years. All those threats, counter-threats, accusations, and grandstanding served only to temporarily rattle a billion-dollar agreement signed 20 years earlier for delivery of 101 RD-180 engines. As for U.S.-Russian issues around the ISS, the grandstanding has come to naught there, too. Russia's threat in 2014 to cease collaboration as of 2020 would have meant, in practice, that the United States would have to abandon its own part of the station. Why? Because the Russian part, specifically the service module Zvezda, includes systems used by the entire spacecraft, notably for life support functions such as cooling, dehumidifying, and separating oxygen from water. Back in 2014, Russia's straight-talking deputy prime minister had said the Russian segment can exist independently from the American one. The U.S. one cannot. By the following year, as space journalist Anatoly Zak writes, cooler heads in Moscow prevailed. Russia would stick with the ISS collaboration all the way through 2024. At no point during all these tensions did Russia stop ferrying astronauts to and from the ISS via its Soyuz capsule. Maybe, just maybe, it's because NASA pays Roscosmos $82 million per seat for a round trip in 2018, up from $21 million in 2006. As the world's most ambitious space power, the People's Republic of China presents the United States of America with unique conundrums. To policymakers who are committed to American global dominance, China is an adversary, a threat, not an ally or a potential partner. Collaboration, in their view, is unwise. China is the 21st century economic powerhouse. For 2016, the World Bank ranked China number one in a nuanced version of gross domestic product, GDP, based not simply on the total market value of all the country's goods and services, but on the relative purchasing power of its currency. By that measure, the United States ranked number two. The economic fallout is telling. For 8 years, until it began to dump U.S. Treasury bonds in late 2016, China was the USA's biggest foreign creditor. In 2017, the United States ran a balance of trade deficit, far more imports than exports, of $375 billion with China, exceeding the $350 billion racked up in 2016. As for space power, Joan Johnson Fries contends that the potential for China as a peer competitor to the United States is a consistent concern of those who view zero-sum competition as inevitable. Michael Sheehan contends that China has no reason to accept America's self-appointed hegemonic dominance of space and has sought to negate it through a policy of encouraging multipolar modifications to the international space regime. The 2016 Annual Department of Defense report on Chinese military capabilities states that although during 2015, China demonstrated a willingness to tolerate higher levels of tension in the pursuit of its interests, it still seeks to avoid direct and explicit conflict with the United States. Longer term, however, China's military modernization is producing capabilities that have the potential to reduce core U.S. military technological advantages. One example of that modernization is a new branch, the Strategic Support Force, created by the People's Liberation Army on the final day of 2015. Its focus is space, cyber, and electronic warfare capabilities. Another aspect of the modernization, according to the 2017 version of the report, is China's increasing interest in missions beyond its periphery, including power projection, disaster relief, and the building of foreign bases. China's leaders, states the report, now seek stable relations and want to be seen as pursuing policies of peaceful development. But China is also increasingly assertive and sees the United States as the dominant regional and global actor with the greatest potential either to support or disrupt China's rise. As for the Strategic Support Force, it's going great guns on counter-space capabilities, the manufacture of spacecraft and space launch vehicles, human spaceflight, and the in-space assembly of its very own space station. Unlike Europe, the United States has persistently opposed Chinese participation in the International Space Station. In the early days of space station planning, before China was seen as a real or imagined threat to U.S. space dominance, the denunciation of Chinese human rights violations was an easy way to exclude the People's Republic from America's space sandbox. The year the Berlin Wall fell, 1989, was also the year of the student-led Tiananmen Square protests in Beijing, which snared global headlines, ended with the shooting of both students and workers, and engendered an international outcry. The noisier the professed outrage against Red China and the cruelties of Tiananmen Square, the less likely became any invitation to participate in the ISS. Yet during the next decade, as space writer Brian Harvey recounts, China made several pitches to join the ISS project, dropping heavy hints to visiting journalists and officials of other space programs, especially the Europeans. The U.S. response was an uncompromising brush-off. That brush-off stemmed from the Cox Committee in the House of Representatives. Formed in 1998, the committee was driven by U.S. readiness to view China as a malicious global actor. Its mandate was to investigate any transfers of technology, information, advice, goods, or services that may have contributed to the improvement of China's weaponry or intelligence capabilities. Its approach had the flavor of 1950s-style McCarthyism. Johnson Freeze calls the Cox Committee's efforts melodramatic, sensational, technically challenged, and politically trumped up. Seemingly overnight, she writes, communication satellites were described as threats to U.S. national security, and as dual-use technology, they became subject to the same government controls as military satellites, tanks, or guns for purposes of sale overseas. No longer was civilian space technology impressive multipurpose engineering. Now it was potential armaments subject to AECA, the Arms Export Control Act, USML, the U.S. munitions list, and its definitions of sensitive U.S. technology. COCOM, the Coordinating Committee on Multilateral Export Controls, the VASNA arrangement on export controls for conventional weapons and dual-use goods and technologies, and especially to ITAR, the International Traffic in Arms Regulations, which, when broadly implemented, thwarted the free exchange of scientific and technological ideas in the name of national security. A curious portfolio of political posturing, given that various other countries, aided by U.S. efforts that had begun in the 1960s, were quite capable of producing that technology by the 1990s, and large swaths of relevant engineering advances were already in the public domain. The Cox Committee's final report opened with accusations against the People's Republic of China that it had stolen design information on the United States' most advanced thermonuclear weapons and had penetrated our national weapons laboratories. The highest profile individual victim was Los Alamos scientist Wen-Ho Lee, a Taiwan-born U.S. citizen who in 1999 was labeled a spy, fired without review, and held for 278 days without bail in solitary confinement for downloading restricted data until a federal judge ordered his release, expressing his great sadness at having been led astray last December by the executive branch of our government, who have embarrassed our entire nation by the way this case began and was handled. The government ended up dropping 58 of its 59 charges. All told, these measures to restrict space exports and freeze out a potential competitor may have created more problems than they solved. U.S. aerospace jobs and global market share took a major, lasting dive. China began to pursue an independently cooperative path in space, including its own space station, which would welcome attachable foreign modules for long-term stays, and foreign crew transport vehicles for short stays. One bizarre piece of the picture is that a few months after the Cox report came out, Congress voted to make China one of America's most favored nation partners in trade, except for aerospace. Meanwhile, France and Britain began to work with China to develop ITAR-free spacecraft, circumventing U.S. restrictions. Russian-Chinese cooperation continued. China's Long March rockets became an attractive, moderate-cost launch option available to other countries. By 2007, China had displaced Europe from third place as a satellite launching power behind Russia and the United States. By 2011, it had displaced the United States. James Clay Moltz concludes that China had gone a long way toward successfully outflanking the U.S. sanctions, although it also attracted unwanted attention to the continued central role of the military in its space program. Despite America's obvious inability to keep pace with the fast-growing international space community, Congress was obstinate. In late 2011, both houses agreed to include a provision in the Annual Appropriations Act that explicitly prohibited NASA from engaging in any contract or collaboration with China that would enable Chinese access to advanced Western technologies associated with national security or economic security. Nor could Chinese officials even set foot in a NASA facility. So counterproductive, constraining, and ungenerous were these policies of exclusion that U.S. officials, including not only heads of NASA, but even presidents, periodically ignored them or at least pushed the envelope. In 2005, the United States gave China tracking data on space debris to help ensure a safe trajectory for a Shenzhou manned mission. In 2006, President George W. Bush proposed to President Hu Jintao that America and China would benefit from significant space cooperation in the unspecified future. That same year, NASA Administrator Michael Griffin met the Assistant Administrator of the CNSA on American soil and later, despite opposition from some members of Congress, traveled to China. Though once there, he was forbidden access to the military-controlled space facilities. Following their summit in 2009, President Obama and President Hu called for expanding discussions on space science cooperation and starting a dialogue on human space flight and space exploration. In 2010, Charles Bolden, the next NASA administrator, had a better visit to China than his predecessors. In 2014, satellites were removed from the ITAR list. By 2015, discussions about inviting a Chinese taikonaut, Yuhong Yuan, Traveler of the Universe, aboard the International Space Station were underway. John Logsdon, founder of the Space Policy Institute at George Washington University, points out that the 2011 prohibitions are merely bilateral and that welcoming China into the multilateral ISS would be a politically smart escape route from current limitations. Johnson, Fries, and Sheehan point out that the docking mechanism for China's manned Shenzhou spacecraft is a Russian design, already in use on the International Space Station to accommodate both Russian and U.S. vehicles. Nevertheless, no taikonaut has yet served as an ISS crew member. But as Johnson Fries suggests, China's own evolving Tiangong Space Station, which will enjoy the cooperation of the European Space Agency, stands a chance of becoming the de facto International Space Station when America and Russia say goodbye to the ISS. On January 20th, 2017, Donald J. Trump was sworn into office as President of the United States. 1 week later, he issued an executive order permanently barring refugees from Syria and temporarily refusing entry to immigrants from 7 Muslim-majority nations, whether the immigrants were first-time applicants or returnees from travel abroad. Thousands of people and scores of lawyers massed at airports in protest, and the order ended up in court. Experts in many fields used their power and prestige to decry the ban on immigration and travel. Scientists were no exception. After all, the laws of the universe transcend nationality, ethnicity, and genetic heritage. The International Astronomical Union's Secretary General urged that any new or existing limitations to the free circulation of world citizens take into account the necessary mobility of astronomers as well as human rights at large. The Royal Astronomical Society characterized the ban as hindering researchers from sharing their work with their peers, a fundamental tenet of scientific endeavor. Almost 200 American scientific organizations and universities added their names to a letter to the president warning that the ban would discourage many of the best and brightest international students, scholars, engineers, and scientists from studying and working, attending academic and scientific conferences, or seeking to build new businesses in the United States. Even before the new president took office, physicist Richard L. Garwin organized an open letter to Trump that was signed by several dozen specialists in the physics and technology of nuclear power and of nuclear weapons, including a number of Nobel laureates. The signatories contended that the multilateral Iran deal, often derided by the president during the election campaign as the worst deal ever negotiated, was in fact a strong bulwark against an Iranian nuclear weapons program. To date, this deal is still in place. In late January, just days after huge women's marches took place across the world, concerned scientists made a decision to hold a March for Science in Washington, D.C. on April 22, 2017. More than 300 scientific organizations, including the American Astronomical Society and the Planetary Society, signed on as partners. On the designated day, the global roster of satellite marches numbered 610. Why march? People who value science have remained silent for far too long in the face of policies that ignore scientific evidence and endanger both human life and the future of our world, answered the organizers. We face a possible future where people not only ignore scientific evidence, but seek to eliminate it entirely. Staying silent is a luxury that we can no longer afford. What can we afford? As of late March, the new administration's budget ideas for the remainder of fiscal year 2017 included a $52.3 billion, 10%, increase for the Department of Defense, coupled with large percentage cuts in most other departments, agencies, and programs. From the State Department, 29%, to the Environmental Protection Agency, 31%, and the Advanced Research Projects Agency, Energy, 50%, along with the elimination of funding for indulgences such as the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. NASA was to squeak by with a 1% cut. But in early May 2017, Congress had other ideas. A 3% increase for NASA science inside a 2% increase for NASA overall. ARPA-E got a 5% increase, while the NEA, NEH, and CPB were held flat. For fiscal year 2018, funding for the Department of Defense's S&T programs jumped 6%, with applied research and advanced technology development leading the way. Turning designs into operational capabilities was the goal, with directed energy weapons a popular line item. Reaction against America's 45th president, his administration, his supporters, and his party has come from many quarters. But with any increase in popular resistance comes an increased possibility of retaliation by those with more obvious, more weaponized power. In a confrontation between the many and the few, military power is never irrelevant. Deployed on orders from any government, military power is not autonomous. It is a tool of policy. And as the military has told us in hundreds of ways, in thousands of documents, space power, especially the many kinds of satellites in Earth orbit, is now an indispensable piece of the warfighter's arsenal. As with other forms of power, near-Earth space power can be used for both protection and persecution, against an individual or a group, a building or a bridge, a domestic threat or a foreign militia. It can be used against the citizenry at large. The many varieties of surveillance can be both legitimate and illegitimate, snaring known enemies and unforeseen attacks as readily as random passers-by and random trysts. Satellite surveillance of North Korean missile launch sites provides a crucial source of forewarning for North Korea's neighbors, whereas the satellite tracking of cars in Xinjiang province, where the Chinese government has mandated that a positioning system be installed in all vehicles as part of its anti-terror campaign, smells more like government overreach and invasion of privacy. Space power, as embraced and exercised by the military, seems worlds away from the power of space, as understood by the astrophysicist. Yet, as we've seen, they intersect surprisingly often to mutual advantage. Across history, the roster of nations that wielded the most power on the world stage, military as well as economic, strongly coincides with the roster of nations whose scientists were the most knowledgeable about the doings of the universe. What propelled America to the moon was not science or exploration, but fear and competition with the Soviet Union. A contest of worldviews. A battle of political and economic philosophies. Might the subsequent rocket rise of China, in every way that matters on the world stage, economic, political, technological, military, propel America back into space? Is a formidable space-faring adversary a more powerful inducement than a peaceable ally? In the 1960s, faced with a Cold War space adversary, the United States placed the boot prints of 12 astronauts on the dusty lunar surface. Since then, faced with peacetime ISS collaborators, our astronauts have stayed in low Earth orbit, boldly going where hundreds have gone before. Cosmic discovery is often enabled even when it's not the driver, and even when the show of force is not weapons, but technological bravado. All Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts, except one, served in the U.S. military. Yet it was NASA, a civilian agency, that sent them into space. Soft power at its finest. Science budgets didn't pay for the moon landings, but science certainly benefited. The astrophysical history of the Earth-Moon system and the geology of the lunar surface came into sharp focus only after the rocks collected by Apollo astronauts were returned to Earth for analysis. Interplanetary space is the next arena where the soft power of technological bravado, augmented by the lure of unlimited resources, urges us to take flight. Chapter 9. A Time to Heal. On July 21st, 1969, the day the New York Times banner headline read, "Men Walk on Moon, Astronauts Land on Plane, Collect Rocks, Plant Flag." The paper also provided space for reactions from several dozen notable individuals, the Dalai Lama, R. Buckminster Fuller, Jesse Jackson, Charles Lindbergh, Arthur Miller, Pablo Picasso. Some were enthusiastic, some were ambivalent. Picasso was completely uninterested. The admired historian of cities and technology, Lewis Mumford, was disgusted. 5 years earlier, Mumford had received the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Now, he felt impelled to describe the foremost scientific and technical achievements of the modern era, rockets, computers, nuclear bombs, as direct products of war, hyped as research and development, for military and political ends that would shrivel under rational examination and candid moral appraisal. The moon landing program is no exception. It is a symbolic act of war, and the slogan the astronauts will carry, proclaiming that it is for the benefit of mankind, is on the same level as the Air Force's monstrous hypocrisy. Our profession is peace. Mumford also painted America's moon program as a ravenous beast, maiming or devouring all other human enterprises. It is no accident that the climactic moon landing coincides with cutbacks in education, the bankruptcy of hospital services, the closing of libraries and museums, and the mounting defilement of the urban and natural environment, to say nothing of many other evidences of gross social failure and human deterioration. Saying technological triumphs had brought the moonstruck human species to the brink of catastrophe, Mumford called out the proponents of space exploration for their duplicity in lavishing support on the power elite, while making the scientifically uninformed believe that a better future may await mankind on the sterile moon or on an even more life-hostile Mars. Yet many of the world's inhabitants derive conspicuous collateral benefits from scientific and technical advances that started life as military projects. Communications and weather satellites, GPS, medical technologies, and mobile phones help both the farmer in rural India and the surgeon in a Manhattan hospital. As a form of protection, militarization of space might seem inevitable, even desirable, as a kind of shield for our growing orbital assets. But weaponization arrives close on the heels of militarization. On the other hand, humanity has officially embraced a peaceable space agenda. Drawn up by the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, the 1967 Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and other celestial bodies, is ambitious and inspiring. Yet who among us believes that humans will act peacefully in space? Space is not a magical place where somehow, suddenly everybody is friendly. We remain the same species, with the same primal urges as our tribal ancestors. How about working on the peaceful uses of Earth? Once we figure those out, maybe we'll be able to non-delusionally envision the peaceful uses of space. One way to assess a society is to examine how it rewards or punishes those who act on primal urges, how it attempts to encourage, channel, or inhibit those urges. But is war primal? That civilization exists at all, that at any given moment most people and most nation-states are not waging war on one another, implies that we are not entirely hapless victims of an opportunistic compulsion awaiting a time to kill. We may also be capable of opportunistically seizing a time to heal. Being a scientist, when I think of how and where and when healing could take place, I think of knowledge, rational analysis, cooperation. I think of what it would be like to live in a country, let's call it rationalia, in which all decisions that affect the population as a whole would flow from a single constitutional tenet. Laws shall be based only on the weight of evidence, which means that where evidence is inconclusive, there can be no law. In rationalia, I contend, space exploration could conceivably serve as the ultimate healer, offering the high road to peace. To talk about sources of peace, you have to ask, what have been the causes, costs, and casualties of war? One is a scarcity of natural resources, oil, fresh water, salt, nitrates, ores, guano, shipworthy timber. Dwindling or interrupted access to each of these commodities has figured in past armed conflict. So-called rare earth metals such as yttrium, dysprosium, and neodymium, along with others that complete an entire row of the periodic table of elements, could easily join this list. Tech sectors thrive on rare earth elements. Without them, America's electronics, defense, and green energy industries would implode. We wouldn't have satellites, smartphones, lightweight laptops, jet engines, missile guidance systems, anti-missile defense systems, nuclear reactor shielding, lasers, catalytic converters, rechargeable batteries for hybrid vehicles, magnets for speakers and headphones, advanced wind turbines, LED lighting systems, MRI scans, or energy-efficient air conditioners. About 90% of the world's supply currently comes from China. Other sources in descending order of productivity are Australia, Russia, and India. Until 1989, the United States, specifically the Open Pit Mountain Pass Mine in California, was the world's main producer. But after supplying plenty of europium for the red tones in color TVs while leaking radioactive wastewater into the surroundings for a decade or two, the mine stopped operations and eventually declared bankruptcy. China offered a cheaper alternative, forcing the United States to sell off its stockpiles. Now every industrialized country is in thrall to Chinese suppliers, who are acutely aware of the economic and strategic implications of being the dominant supplier of scarce resources with inelastic demand. But there's a remedy. What's contested on Earth because of scarcity is typically common in space. Selected asteroids contain unlimited quantities of metals and minerals. Comets have unlimited quantities of water. And solar energy is boundless in the empty space between planets. Access to space gives us access to these resources, even if control of that access rests in the hands of people you'd hate to be in control of anything. The resources themselves will not be scarce, and it's scarcity that breeds conflict. Asteroids are fragments of planets that didn't stay planetized. They start their lives through accretion. Debris collects in space, and any speck that's slightly bigger than the surrounding specks will have more gravity and attract more debris. Soon you'll have blobs rather than just specks. A big blob gets bigger faster than a small blob. Meanwhile, a lot of energy is getting deposited on what we would now call a protoplanet, as the kinetic energy from other colliding specks and blobs accumulates. For a couple hundred million years during the late childhood of our solar system, a period sensibly called the late heavy bombardment, those collisions were significant and continual. with kinetic energy converting entirely to heat on impact, the deposited energy renders the protoplanet molten. And when you're molten, dense ingredients, such as pure heavy metals, fall toward your middle, and less dense ingredients, such as silicates, rise to your surface. By this process, nature pre-sifts heavy things from light things, which geologists label with a six-syllable word, differentiation. All of Earth was once molten. That's why it has an iron-rich core, containing abundant quantities of other metals that are rare on the surface. Rare earth metals are not actually rare. They're simply not found in any significant concentration in Earth's crust, and we have no access to Earth's core, where they lie in abundance. The deepest we've ever drilled is less than 1/500th the distance to the center of our planet, and the core extends to half the planet's radius. Eventually, every molten object cools and solidifies. But if a big, fast-moving object then slams into it, you get a shattered, scattered field of pre-sifted space debris. That's how you get entire asteroids made of pure rock and others of pure metal. What matters to the future space miner is that some asteroids came from a protoplanet's shattered differentiated core, and they're packed with rare earth metals as well as other metals we deem precious, including gold, silver, platinum, iridium, and palladium. Once you have access to multiple sources of rare earth metals, you no longer have to worry about anybody's unilateral control of the strategic supply. Yes, space prospectors number one, a country or a private company, will be the first to start mining the nearest rare earth-laden asteroid and will therefore control that part of the supply. But so what? Space prospectors number two will just plan to get a different asteroid and start mining that one. At which time, normal economic and political forces began to kick in. SP1, the pioneer, will not want to see anyone starting up a mine on a different asteroid. They'll want the rest of us to buy the rare earths they've mined, so they'll price their product at the point where it's cheaper for everyone to buy SP1 metals than to send their own missions to other asteroids. If SP1 goes above that price point, the rest of us will just go out and mine our own asteroids. Unquestionably, asteroid mining will one day be a trillion-dollar industry, even if the vast increase in supply depresses the high prices at which rare earths are currently traded. As the price of highly useful goods drops, the number of affordable applications tends to grow. In the shorter run, however, since asteroid mining won't start tomorrow, although startups are multiplying and the Finnish Meteorological Institute, for instance, is proposing a fleet of solar wind-powered nanosatellites to collect data on the composition of several hundred asteroids, we'll have to come up with other solutions. Maybe someone will invent a smartphone that doesn't need dysprosium. Maybe someone else will finally invent a storage mechanism in lieu of batteries for stockpiling solar energy. Asteroids aren't the only small celestial bodies that can bring us a little more peace and security. Some comets contain as much water as the entire Indian Ocean, and it's not salt water. Do a bit of filtering, and you get fresh water. The way to snare a comet is to match orbits with it and break off a piece, which should be very easy. Comets are loosely held together like snowballs made of dry snow. They look for excuses to break apart. Even the gentlest nudge from the tidal forces of a passing planet will do. Once you've grabbed a piece of the comet, you could put it in orbit around the site where the need exists, Earth, the Moon, Mars, wherever, and intermittently go up and grab iceberg-sized chunks of it. Of course, you'll have to figure out how to accomplish all that, but you'd be working on engineering problems, not scientific ones. Any clever engineer would delight in being tasked to solve them. There you have it. One vision of a future avenue to peace and healing. In the centuries-long alliance between warfighters and skywatchers, the two sides have more often been in sync than at odds. Now, astrophysicists and space scientists, heirs of the skywatchers of yore, may hold the power to erase a perennial rationale for war. But we're not there yet. For millennia, war between nations, regions, religious factions, clans, or generally disagreeing or competing humans seems to have been always on the horizon or underway. Yet despite its ubiquity and persistence, we, or at least we Americans, have forgotten the meaning of war, wrote the noted historian Tony Judt not long before his death. In part, this is, perhaps, because the impact of war in the 20th century, though global in reach, was not everywhere the same. In Africa, in Europe, in Latin America, in Asia, in the Middle East, war in the last century signified occupation, displacement, deprivation, destruction, and mass murder, the loss of family and neighbors, homes and shops, personal safety and national autonomy. For both victors and losers, and both sides in the long strings of civil wars, the memories of horror were similar. The United States, on the other hand, avoided all that. Americans experienced the 20th century in a far more positive light. The U.S. was never occupied. It did not lose vast numbers of citizens or huge swaths of national territory as a result of occupation or dismemberment. Although humiliated in neo-colonial wars in Vietnam and now in Iraq, it has never suffered the other consequences of defeat. Despite the ambivalence of its most recent undertakings, most Americans still feel that the wars their country has fought were good wars. The USA was enriched rather than impoverished by its role in the two world wars and by their outcome. And thus, for many American commentators and policymakers, the message of the last century is that war works. For Washington, war remains an option. In this case, the first option. For the rest of the developed world, it has become a last resort. If an all-out, space-enabled war should ever occur, it would bear no resemblance to the world wars portrayed in All Quiet on the Western Front, or The Naked and the Dead, or the poems of Siegfried Sassoon and Wilfred Owen. Nor would it be like Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan. There would be no muddy, stinking trenches or sweltering, unforgiving deserts. 19-year-old boys would not blindly stagger through jungles half a world away. No Marine would see his buddy's head blown half off a yard from where he crouched. True space-age war would be sanitized, emotionless, thorough, and likely brief. Nations would fail in a day. However often American public figures proclaim their country's prominence or dominance, the work that must be done in this century is inescapably cooperative, a point made by President Barack Obama in a speech to the UN General Assembly 8 months after taking office. My responsibility is to act in the interest of my nation and my people, and I will never apologize for defending those interests. But it is my deeply held belief that in the year 2009, more than at any point in human history, the interests of nations and peoples are shared. The technology we harness can light the path to peace or forever darken it. In an era when our destiny is shared, power is no longer a zero-sum game. No one nation can or should try to dominate another nation. No world order that elevates one nation or group of people over another will succeed. No balance of power among nations will hold. Were this understanding, that dominance cannot be the cornerstone of security in an interconnected world, ever to take root, the resulting cooperation would not only help forestall an arms race in outer space, but could also help rescue our home planet from some of the upheavals of climate change. The Paris Agreement, the 2016 United Nations Climate Accord, accepted by 197 parties as of early 2018, represents the first time that rigorous scientific consensus has shaped the political agenda of the world. People in power have learned that air and water molecules do not carry passports, as the American astrophysicist Carl Sagan was fond of saying. A melting glacier raises the sea level of all the world's coastlines. Greenhouse gases generated in one area of Earth mix swiftly with air currents that carry them to all areas of Earth. Warming air and warming ocean currents do not observe national boundaries or property rights. Neither would the thousands of deadly fragments of wayward orbital debris that an attack on a satellite would produce. No longer can the inhabitants of Earth survive as a collection of tribes, each looking out for only its own members. The world itself has become a tribe. The same day Obama spoke at the United Nations, the journal Nature published grave news about the drastically accelerated melting of ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland in 2003 through 2007 compared with that of the preceding decade. This was a finding by British climatologists who based their determination on 50 million laser readings from a NASA satellite. An instance of international cooperation, in this case, between allies. But adversaries, too, sometimes toss a little cooperation in with their confrontations. It's diplomacy's forte. In July 2015, U.S.-Russian relations pointed toward the dawn of Cold War 2.0. Inflammatory rhetoric had been ratcheted up in the wake of Russia's annexation of the Crimean Peninsula and Russian military incursions across the Ukrainian border. In response, the United States had led the call for Western sanctions against Russia. Yet all that bad blood did not keep Russia from sending an unmanned cargo ship packed with food, water, oxygen, and equipment to the International Space Station to do what the community of spacefaring nations needed done following the failure of three supply missions within 7 months. Two U.S. failures and one Russian. Russia deployed its reliable Soyuz U rocket not merely because the space station's crew consisted of two Russians and an American, not merely because Russia and America are founding partners of the ISS, but also because of the hefty sums Russia had been getting as sole provider of transport to the ISS. Yes, it's complicated. And yes, there's no shortage of contradictions. But in the end, off-planet survival among space-faring comrades can override them all. One notable 20th century result of the countless alliances between astrophysics and the military is the thermonuclear fusion bomb, whose design principles arise in part from the astrophysicists' investigations of the cosmic crucible that occupies the center of every star. A less explosive example from our own century is the ChemCam instrument, short for chemistry and camera, atop the Curiosity rover, which began trundling across Mars in August 2012. From its skybox position on the rover's mast, ChemCam fires laser pulses at rocks and soil, and then uses its spectrometer to analyze the chemical makeup of what got vaporized. Who or what built ChemCam? The Los Alamos National Laboratory, birthplace of the atom bomb, originator of hundreds of spacecraft instruments designed for use by the military, and home to the Center for Earth and Space Science, a division of the National Security Education Center, as well as a hub of support for astrophysics. Los Alamos Lab operates under the auspices of the National Nuclear Security Administration, whose mission is to maintain and protect America's stockpile of nuclear weapons while simultaneously working to undercut the proliferation of such stockpiles elsewhere in the world. And the lab's astrophysicists use the same supercomputer and similar software to calculate the yield from hydrogen fusion within the heart of a star that physicists use to calculate the yield of a hydrogen bomb. You'd have to look far and wide to find a clearer example of dual use. Say you want to know what takes place during the explosion of a nuclear bomb. If you were to tabulate the many varieties of subatomic particles and track the ways they interact and transmute into one another under controlled conditions of temperature and pressure, not to mention the particles that get created or destroyed in the process, you'd quickly realize you need more than pencil and paper. You need computers, powerful computers. A properly programmed computer can calculate crucial parameters for nuclear bomb design, ignition, and explosive yields, so it can predict what to expect from an experiment. Of course, experiment means the actual detonation of a nuclear bomb, either in a test or in warfare. During the Manhattan Project in the 1940s, Los Alamos used mechanical calculators and early IBM punch card tabulators to calculate atomic bomb yields. Decade by decade, as computing power increased exponentially, so too did the power to calculate and understand in detail the nuclear happenings in a nuclear explosion. And the needs of Los Alamos fostered the sustained quest to build the fastest computer in the world. Second-generation computers of the 1960s, furnished with transistors that greatly accelerated their performance, in part made the 1963 Nuclear Test Ban Treaty possible. While later generations of computers didn't stop the arms race, they did offer a viable way to test weapon systems without actually detonating anything. By 1998, the Los Alamos supercomputer Blue Mountain could run 1.6 trillion calculations per second. By 2009, the lab's Roadrunner had increased that speed more than 600-fold to the milestone of 1 quadrillion calculations per second. And by late 2017, its Trinity supercomputer had racked up another factor of 14 in computing power. We know that stars generate energy in exactly the same way that hydrogen bombs do. The difference is that the controlled nuclear fusion that happens in the star's core is contained by the weight of the star itself, whereas in warfare the nuclear fusion is positively uncontrolled, the precise objective of a bomb. And that is why astrophysicists have long been associated with Los Alamos National Lab and its supercomputers. Picture scientists working away on opposite sides of a classified wall. On one side, you have researchers engaged in secret projects that are responsible for enhancing national security through the military application of nuclear science. On the other side, you have researchers trying to figure out how stars in the universe live and die. Each side is accessory to the other's needs, interests, and resources. If you seek more evidence, search the SAO NASA